Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are going to be talking about sewage and torture, two of the cheeriest subjects you could possibly imagine. So strap in, here we go. We're going to be talking later on to Dr. Grimm, the Eye's human rights correspondent, who has been covering a number of situations, most particularly in recent weeks, the situation in Iranian prisons, the story of Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe, who's been incarcerated by the Iranian government for some years on trumped up charges, has been covered a great deal, and Dr. Grimm has been writing a little bit about the situation for other prisoners of the Iranian regime. We'll be hearing that later. But first of all, raw sewage is flooding into your coastal waters and your rivers. Doesn't sound nice, does it? Well, it's not. It's disgusting, and it's happening more and more. This story has been in the news a fair bit recently because there is some legislation currently working its way through the Commons and the Lords relating to it, and it's to do with the fact that on more and more occasions, water companies are discharging raw sewage into England's rivers and coastal waters. In 2020 alone, it happened over 400,000 times for a duration of 3 million hours. Now, you might think this sounds appalling and someone should be doing something about it. The fact is, it's permitted, and at the moment, it's happening a great deal more frequently. Britain's sewage infrastructure is old, it's not kept pace with the growth of population. It's not kept pace, for example, with climate change, which is leading to more extreme rainfall, which means that the sewage system is more frequently overwhelmed. As a result, the only alternative to sewage flowing backwards into businesses, homes, and toilets across the country is for it to flow out into rivers and coastal waters. There are regulatory bodies who are meant to be dealing with this. Two of the chief bodies regulating the water and sewerage sectors are the Environment Agency and Ofwat, but they don't seem to be able to do much about it. Water companies in England are privatised. The old system was nationalised, and in 1989, there were 32 new companies formed across England and Wales to replace the old system. That has led to very large dividends being paid out to shareholders in those firms, but it doesn't seem to have dealt with the main problem. I spoke to Jane McKenzie, who's been writing about this problem in the pages of Private Eye for many years now, and I started off by asking her why these kind of sewage outflows are permitted on so many occasions. Here's Jane.
So the story most recently was that because of the various issues with haulage and supply that have been going on in all kinds of sectors, one of the things that there were concerns about there being a shortage of was the chemicals used for sewage treatment. The Environment Agency was sort of taking a preemptive action to say, if you can't get a hold of it, then we will give you a sort of advance permission to put some poo out there rather than prosecute you afterwards.
Yes, it is interesting because I think if you weren't following the story, it would be quite surprising to read that there is such a thing as a permitted sewage outflow, which is absolutely fine, as opposed to obviously a non-permitted sewage outflow, which is a very bad thing and ought to be stamped down on.
They were permitted in the first place as a sort of deliberate loophole, because when the water sector was privatised, there was a concern that on the day that the companies were handed over out of the public sector, they'd then just have to arrest all the water companies, because at that point there were so many of these and they were polluting so badly that every water company would have been committing criminal offences. They created a sort of a loophole with what was supposed to be a sort of long-term plan that they would all, as they made profits in the water sector, spend some of that on improving the really very problematic infrastructure. And, you know, the argument in favour of water privatisation was that as profits were made, it could be spent on upgrading these terrible Victorian sewers that were making nowhere swimmable and could really kind of upgrade everything. And, of course, 20 years went by and they hadn't. And at that point, the Environment Agency tried to have a push on getting them to get their act together and ultimately lost in an appeal. The water companies were given more time to carry on sorting it out. And so this latest sort of battle in Parliament, where the Lords have tried to impose a amendment to the new Environment Bill to say, could they stop spewing sort of sewage out through storm sewers, is sort of yet another stage of this process where the water companies have just kept getting it deferred forevermore.
It sounds unbelievable when you put it like that, that there are just these endless stays of execution provided to the water companies, which have been making substantial amounts of money from their ownership of water supply for many years now. What is the reason that the Environment Agency hasn't been able to haul them over the coals and say, if this isn't done within the next 2 years, there are going to be serious consequences, we're going to take away all the dividends, or whatever it might be?
Well, the Environment Agency is increasingly powerless and tiny. Even the actually illegal things they don't have consents to let out from the water companies, the Environment Agency has fewer and fewer people, for one thing, and just sort of resources to do anything about. It is a third the size it was in 2010, and yet they still have the same amount of polluters and so on to deal with. So it's not just in the water sector that we're seeing this. We had a story recently about a disgusting, stinky landfill site that the Environment Agency just hadn't had the resources to deal with. So polluters across the board are getting away with more because the sort of body that has powers just doesn't have resources to use those powers.
It's atrocious, Jane. It's really appalling.
I know.
I mean, and you've been writing about this for such a long time.
That's right.
Do you avoid the brick wall head feeling at times like this? When it's back in the news again,
yes,
and nothing has been done again.
Again and again. And before my time, somebody, certainly probably Paul Foot, but the In the Back Pages have been on this sort of for years before I even arrived at the Eye. There have also been a small number of very good campaign groups sort of banging on about this same issue, partly because their hobbies very much require going into the water or looking at the water a lot. So these groups are Surface Against Sewage and the Angling Trust. So the Angling Trust watch rivers day in, day out while waiting for a fish to bite. So they know how many turds float past.
Right.
And they see the problems and they see it in the health of the fish as well. And the surfers are obviously dealing with the sea-based sewage outfalls and don't want to be going out into sort of lovely big waves and finding some sanitary products floating along with them.
How about the wild swimmers? Have they got involved yet? Feels like they haven't maybe organised as a lobbyist.
Yeah, they don't have the longevity of those two groups who really have. I mean, they've done the work on campaigning against sewage. Unfortunately, they haven't made an awful lot of headway in some ways, but they are there and have really stayed with this, which for a lot of people is not an issue they want to spend a lot of time thinking about.
I mean, most people don't spend their time close to water, so that means it's harder for the image to get salience in the way that other things would.
I mean, for a lot of us, sort of our time spent in the sea around the UK coast might be sort of once a summer. It's not as much on everybody's minds. But the cleanness of our beaches and sea is sadly just horrible. And the rivers are, some of them are in an atrocious condition.
And so short of this just erupting into the public consciousness every so often for a while and then going away again, what are the longer lasting things that can be done about this? Is there legislation?
The Lords just had a very good go at amending the bill to say that should go there. So something like that, the water regulator has some powers off what to sort of set these as targets for the water companies and to say, you know, you don't get your big dividends if you carry on, and we will stop allowing consents for outflows. You have had more than enough time. Yes, we couldn't in 1989 suddenly prosecute you all for years of neglect by governments of the water system, but you've now had decades of neglect by the water companies. And there are things that they can do. It's not an impossible thing to solve.
Yeah. Despite that, it doesn't sound like you're very optimistic that this will substantially change the behaviour of the water companies in question.
There's no big indication that they're really sort of seeing the error of their ways over this. They talk about what a terribly big job it is, and they're kind of excuses often, if we don't use the storm sewers, the only other alternative is for the sewage to back up into people's houses, and that would be even worse. No, there is definitely another option, which is to invest in your infrastructure.
Jane McKenzie there. another I correspondent who's been writing about exactly this problem, and in fact the infrastructural solutions that might manage to do something about it, is Karen Liebrich. In the last issue of the magazine, Karen wrote a piece about the TTT, which is also known as the super sewer. And I won't tell you what TTT stands for myself. I will let Karen do that herself. Here she is.
So the TTT is the Thames Tideway Tunnel, which is also known as the super sewer. And it's a 15-mile, 25-kilometre gigantic tunnel under the Thames. It's wide enough to take three London buses. And it runs from Acton in West London and emerges at Beckton in East London. And it literally runs under the Thames.
And what stage is it at? Because I know it's not operational yet.
It was given formal consent in 2014. Owen Paterson was the minister responsible at the time. Contracts were awarded in 2015, and the operating licence was given to Basel Jet Tunnel Limited in November 2015. So it was supposed to be ready in 2023, but now they're beginning to scratch their heads and say 2025. Okay. But it's past the halfway mark, so they've got two tunnelling machines have finished their work, and 16 of the 21 shafts are fully excavated, and the shafts transfer flows from where they go at the moment to where they're supposed to go. So they're digging these shafts all along the edges of the Thames.
Can you describe in a nutshell the problem that the tunnel is intending to solve?
The main problem is that we've got Victorian sewage system. So the Great Basel Jet designed it in the 1860s when it was state of the art and marvellous, and there were 4 million people in London, and now we're 9 million. To put it crudely, we shit more. it was a combined system, so it uses what's called combined sewer overflows. So when it rains, the rain goes through there. So the ideal would be that you have your stormwater and your rain and your sewage, and then you treat the nasty stuff and clean it and hoover out all the nasty bits, and then the grey water either flows into the river or you use it in some
way.
So
just check,
grey is rainwater that's, so it's not been treated, but it's perfectly usable. So ideally you'd use it for watering trees or parks and so on. So when it rains, if it rains hard, and even a few millimetres, if they all come at the same time, the system can't cope. So they open the valves, and then the whole lot, which is rainwater plus poo plus everything else that you put down your loose, it just flows straight out into the Thames. And that increase in population, of course, reflects throughout the country. So London is the biggest, and Thames Water is the biggest of the water companies, but the same thing pretty well happens elsewhere. The sewer overflows were supposed to be a safety valve, so you're supposed to only do it once in a blue moon, but now it's the new normal, and it's pretty well every week. And it would be exorbitantly expensive to get rid of them throughout the whole country. And of course, now we get these extra special kind of monsoon rain style things, with which presumably we're going to get more of with climate change. I don't know if you saw the pictures. There was outside Hammersmith Bridge, there was this enormous geyser of shitty water going up sort of 3-4 meters because the valves couldn't even cope, and it was just sort of shooting up. It was absolutely disgusting. So we've really not paid the attention we should to this, and suddenly we're beginning to. So DEFRA's just established a storm overflows task force about a month ago. And so the idea for the tunnel is that 34 of these most disgusting CSOs, combined sewer overflows, will be diverted. So when it overflows, it will go into the Thames Tunnel, and then it will get taken to the right place and be dealt with, rather than just flowing out. So it's designed to take 30 million tonnes.
So, I mean, on the face of it, before you got to that very last bit, this sounded like an enormous, and clearly it's going to be very expensive, but an enormous and effective solution to this problem, which would hopefully mean no more of these discharges into the Thames. But I'm sensing a bit of doubt.
Well, so it is a huge problem. And I, while preparing for this, I found this marvellous website, which is set up by the Rivers Trust. And I looked at all the overflows near where I live. So for 2020, Mogden spilled 42 times for 413 hours, Kew 20 times for 105 hours, Stanford Brook 6 times for 4 hours, Hammersmith 7 times for 28 hours, Upper Richmond Road 24 times for 223 hours. So it's a lot. And of course, it's heavily diluted, but it's still, you know, swimming in fecal material and so on. So it is more than even the eventual tunnel will be able to cope with. And one of the big arguments at the beginning was that we should have looked into other stuff. Well, one of the arguments was we should have done other stuff instead. Right. And now probably we're happy that they're doing the tunnel, but we think they should do other stuff as well.
And this is the interesting thing. This is the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because your piece in the latest issue of The Eye mentioned SUDs, which are sustainable drainage solutions. And these were proposed as an alternative to the Thames Tideway Tunnel. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
So SUDS is sustainable urban drainage. And sometimes it's called BGI, blue-green infrastructure. So it's rain gardens, green streets, urban forests, green roofs, permeable pavements, permeable asphalt, hedgerows, more trees. These things slow down the water. So when it rains, it doesn't just go straight over your concrete street, asphalt street, whatever, into the drain. It lands on something green, which holds the water, and it slows it down. The plants take some of the water, but then the rest of it is slowed down, so it doesn't all come in one big whoosh. So you don't overwhelm the sewers all in one go. And of course, it provides other benefits. So, you know, habitats and heat absorption and green stuff, you know, whatever, all the benefits of green stuff, which you'll have to give me another podcast to talk about. In the years before the tunnel got the go-ahead, obviously they spent millions on the research. So I think by 2011, £100 million had been spent on the super sewer idea and £200,000 on alternatives. So 100 million, 200,000. Yeah. There's a big difference. And obviously when you ask engineering companies to come up with solutions, they come up with engineering solutions. I mean, Ofwat was not focused on delivery of water-sensitive urban design. It's actually only in July this year that the government said that Ofwat should incentivise water companies to invest to reduce storm overflows. So it's really recently that their brief has included this. And then, of course, you need to bring in, so you need to look at, you know, Highways England, the Housing Ministry, TfL, Ofwat, the Environment Agency. It's a systemic issue that, you know, this is how we build, and we concrete over our front gardens and we concrete over roads, and we need to rethink that. So, for instance, new houses have a right to connect, but the developers don't have to contribute to the capital costs of infrastructure below ground, which would separate the waste from the outflow. So if you build a house with a toilet, you have the right to connect that to the sewage system. But what you don't have to do is connect it in a split-up way.
Separating the grey water, the rainwater.
Rainflow, yes. So when they ran the campaign, I mean, it was very easy. Thames Water ran the campaign at the time, and Andy Triggs Hodge, who was an Olympic rower, I mean, he said things like, you know, I'm paddling through human feces, tampons, condoms, and other nasties. I back the Thames Tunnel, and I mean, who wouldn't? You know, which one would you like? Well, it's obvious. And at the time the tunnel was signed off, we wrote in Private Eye, it's negligent of ministers not to research the alternatives. And just to remind you that the minister at the time was Owen Paterson. But it was complicated, you know, and the simple solution is the engineering solution, really. I mean, it's not simple, of course, but the appealing solution. But it requires changing and enforcing planning requirements to ensure that SUDS is included in all new developments, and retrofitting. And it means that when I want to change my front garden to a hard-standing drive, I should have to do it in a more expensive and irritating way, but that would make my front drive permeable. And so it's lots of small-scale interventions, and it requires political will. So, you know, you need grants and subsidies and fees. So Berlin, for instance, adds a rainwater fee of €1.8 per square metre, and if you put in some blue-green stuff, then you don't have to pay that €1.8 per square metre. And it also requires education, so people need to understand why they're doing it. So when it floods now, you see people saying, oh, you know, when I was a lad, you know, they used to clean the drains and, you know, it ran away. But it's also when you were a lad, probably, not you, but, you know, this mythical person, then not so much was concreted over and there weren't so many of us, and there probably was, maybe the rainfalls were less vicious. But so Sheffield, for instance, they've done a little strip called Grey to Green, and they unveiled it in September. And they'd had huge flooding back in 2007 in Castlegate. So they reclaimed a ring road, and they put in fantastic suds and meadows and a riverside terrace. And it's, for people, it's lovely, and for biodiversity, it's lovely. And that's the biggest stormwater drainage scheme in the UK, but it's only 1 kilometre long. So right. It's fantastic, but it needs to be scaled up. And likewise, the Olympic Park in London, part of that is flood meadows, so it's designed to flood and take water, but that's a little new, enormously expensive project. So you can retrofit it, and even small stuff helps. So I don't know if you've been round Marylebone High Road, they've got sort of low maintenance planting along the sides of the roads. I mean, they look, to the uninitiated, they look just like little flower beds, but actually these serve to collect water and store it for a little while, and it also serves as a pollution, catches particles from cars. So it's a huge problem in cities. So 2/3 of all our front gardens are now partially or wholly covered over.
Wow.
And with electric car charging, we're probably all going to want to be able to do that. If we've got a front drive, we're going to want to park our cars near so we can run the plug out. And of course, parking used to be a God-given right, you know, free parking outside your house, but that's less and less likely. So it's more and more appealing to have your car, if you have a garden, within your garden. So green infrastructure has to become the new normal. And opponents of the tunnel, when it was being worked on at the beginning back in 2011, 2015, they thought SUDs would solve most of it, but it's clear we actually do need the tunnel, but we also need SUDs.
Karen Liebrich there. Thanks to her and to Jay McKenzie for explaining why it's not safe to go back into the water just yet, but watch this space. Now we turn to Iran, and in particular to the Iranian prison system. Private Eye's human rights correspondent is Dr. Grimm, who for many years now has been writing about human rights abuses all around the world. In one of the recent editions of the magazine, she wrote about the situation in Iran. The story best known in the Western press is, of course, of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman who has been incarcerated in Iran with little hope of reprieve for several years now, largely, we think, due to geopolitics between Britain and Iran. But of course, there are thousands of other prisoners in the Iranian prison system who also have their own stories to tell, and Dr. Grimm focused on these stories recently. I spoke to her, and I started off by asking her exactly how we know what it's like inside the Iranian prison system.
Well, the Iranian prison system, it's not easy to see inside it, but there are people inside it who get messages out and who come out and talk about it. And what I wrote about recently with some of the women specifically who had been jailed and who had then come out and explained how they had been tortured and abused and sexually humiliated, both as a part of getting them to confess and once they were in jail. And once they did that, once they published that information, they were again charged, tried and jailed for propaganda against the regime, and either put back or, if they were still there, their sentences increased. And in fact, the charges that, as far as I know, Nazanin has been convicted of are very similar to the charges these women face. It's things like propaganda against the regime, things like sort of collusion against the interests of Iran in various ways, and their sentences passed by the revolutionary courts. You know, this is not like our judicial system, which is separate from our political system, or supposedly, some people would say, perhaps not enough, but it is intended to be and largely functions separately. And Iran has a judicial system also that's intended to function separately to its political system. But it also has the revolutionary courts that sit outside that, and they're answerable to the supreme leader, and they pass and have always passed what we think of as trumped-up charges. They are trumped-up charges, things like propaganda against the regime. I mean, there's a woman in jail for collusion against national security simply because she opposed the death penalty. And these courts have been running ever since the Islamic Revolution. And so what's happened to Nazanin and what happens to these other women becomes to do with the Iranian political system's perception of itself and the world. And it's a sort of, it appears to us certainly to be a kind of paranoid perception. You know, they exist almost as if in a state of war, and anyone who criticises them shall be jailed. And in Nazanin's case, it appears that she didn't have to do anything. It was simply the fact that we as a country weren't doing as they might have wished us to do. And so it appears, anyway. I mean, as you know, everyone has appeared to suggest that the debt that we acknowledge that we owe to Iran is responsible for her continued imprisonment.
Yes, and just for any listeners who don't know about that, that's a debt of about £400 million, which I think was incurred in the 1970s. It was to do with a military contact for some tanks,
which
were then not delivered. Yeah, and the revolution kind of interrupted it.
It did. So we didn't deliver the tanks. There was a period when we said we didn't owe the money because we didn't owe it to the new regime. And then an international court of arbitration decreed that we did owe the money, and we seem to have accepted that we do owe the money. And as you know, Boris Johnson has said, or has undertaken, to repay the money. And so if it wasn't originally all about that, it seems highly likely that it is now. The situation for her is dreadful, and I feel, as many people do, that the government and diplomacy and the powers of government should be able to find a way to resolve this. Particularly having promised to do so, and it's outrageous.
Yes, and the conditions that you describe in the Iranian prison system are truly appalling.
Yes.
It goes far beyond what you might think of beatings or solitary confinement. It's a lot of sexual humiliation, a lot of sexual abuse. And as you say, people are re-incarcerated if they mention the conditions under which they were incarcerated the first time round.
Absolutely. And nothing appears to happen to the people who are treating them appallingly in jail. It's something you see in lots of countries around the world, where people within the justice system are able to treat people within their power in appalling ways. And because nothing happens to them if they do that, it carries on. So, you know, the state is responsible for that, even if they're not insisting that it happens.
When you last appeared on the podcast, we were talking about the Uyghur Muslims and the I think we talked a little bit about the difficulties or the challenges of verification of these cases. Does this situation where people are in prison or just out of it present any extra difficulties for that kind of verification of their stories?
I think it's easier to get to the truth in Iran simply because the people who come out do have an external profile. And, you know, although I'm sure there is censorship, we are seeing their accounts, you know, firsthand from them. And in fact, one of the women I wrote about last week had published diaries, you know, consistently about her time in Bushehr prison, which is a women's prison, and had made formal complaints to Iran about the treatment of other women. So they're not, it's not like in China, it appears that you can't even get a, you know, it's particularly difficult in Xinjiang because no one can talk about it. And that there's a sort of wall of silence has been clamped around those people so that we really don't know what's going on.
Yeah. When you say these diaries are being published, for example, I presume these are being published from outside the country.
No, from inside. Iran hasn't shut down social media in the way that China has for Xinjiang. I mean, there's a woman, it was Gora Kirei, who wrote a novel about stoning in Iran. They still practice stoning, including reportedly a couple of stonings to death in prison of women convicted of, in one case, adultery and murder, and in another case of starring in a pornographic film. And both women were stoned to death. And this woman had written an unpublished novel about stoning in Iran and was jailed for that, you know, because it criticises the regime.
It feels as though if the regime acknowledged that this is going on, even tacitly, by letting these things be published, although admittedly with the threat of re-imprisonment if you go too far or you criticise the regime, and if especially the relations between our own country and Iran are extremely poor, partly due to this unpaid debt and the imprisonment of Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe resulting from it, what can people here do, if anything? It feels like there isn't very much.
No, I don't think there is very much. I mean, I think we should pressure our government to pay its debt, which I think, as Jeremy Hunt said the other day, is a separate matter from Nazanin, but is nevertheless a debt we owe.
Yeah.
You know, we have to behave impeccably, even if they don't. I think that's the first thing. What's very difficult here is that I don't think Iran does appear to be ashamed of or embarrassed by these practices. What they don't like is the criticism of them. And so you can talk about it, but if you do so and you criticise Iran, you go directly back to jail.
Well, it feels as though any talking about it is obviously criticism if you're naming these practices, whereas it feels as though what you're saying is that the regime doesn't see the mere description of these practices as actual criticism.
I think it doesn't see the practices as wrong. But I think implicitly, as you say, once you write about it, then you're criticising and then you've committed an offence. And I think that's been the case for a long time. So, for instance, you know, the woman who has been jailed for joining a rights group that opposes the death penalty. Iran makes no secret of believing it should have a death penalty. But if you join a group that suggests you shouldn't, you are undermining the state, and that's a crime.
Well, I suppose we just will wait and see what happens with the repayment of this debt.
Yes, I mean, I gather there do seem to be moves afoot.
Hmm.
But who knows? I wouldn't want to do something to spike that. And I do hope they find a way, because it is a sort of atrocious situation for that family. But Nazanin is not the only dual citizen who is incarcerated in Iran. And I think we have to remember that, too. Hmm. There are others we should also be working for. So it goes beyond the one case.
Let's turn now to the column that you wrote for the latest edition of the magazine about Syria, specifically about Syrian refugees who left when the war broke out, who are now being compelled to return to Syria, often by Western authorities.
Well, it's about the rather strange decision of Denmark earlier this year, who Denmark has not been granting asylum to Syrian refugees. It's been granting them temporary leave to remain whilst it's unsafe for them to return. And in, I think it was February this year, certainly early spring anyway, Denmark decided that most parts of Syria, or many parts of Syria, were now safe to be returned to by Syrian refugees. And of course, safe is a rather qualified term. If what you mean is, if you're living there, you're no longer likely to be bombed, that may be a form of safe. But for people who have left Syria, returning is proving to be extremely dangerous, because terrible things are happening to them when they go back in at the hands of people who regard the very fact that they left as traitorous. And there are, you know, more than 6 million Syrians outside Syria at the moment, and they are a big refugee problem for many countries who would like to, you know, sort out that refugee problem and have them go back. They would love Syria to be safe for them, but most countries have decided Syria is not safe. The UN and the EU both feel that Syria is not safe, but Denmark, slightly bizarrely, has decided that it has. So it's not deporting its Syrian refugees, it is putting them into deportation centres and telling them that they cannot ever leave there other than to go back to Syria. So some of them have been in Denmark for a number of years, 5-6 years. They've integrated, they've worked, they've paid taxes, they've learnt the language, they've put down roots. And now suddenly they've been told to go back. And what they're hearing out of Syria, and you don't have to look very hard, are stories of what happens to people who do go back. And unlike the situation we've been talking about in Iran, those people disappear. You know, I've worked with victims of torture for a long time and was very well aware that the victims of torture that I got to see were the ones who'd survived. And you survive if your torturer doesn't intend to kill you. You don't survive if he does. People who are tortured in Syria appear not to survive. You know, the very real fear of many of these people is that if they go back, it'll be the last thing they do. And it must be terrifying, and you can read the stories. And so it makes Denmark's decision somewhat unaccountable. We know the Lebanon are pushing refugees out and back to Syria now. We know that Jordan is making it very difficult for refugees to remain by denying them the chance to work and you know, feed their families. There's a sort of worry that there's a sort of push beginning to say, well, you know, it's nearly over in Syria now, so everyone can go home. And I just think it's important to look at what happens to the ones that do before you say that.
And again, the accounts of what happens to people who did return to Syria are a little bit harder to ascertain. But Human Rights Watch, you mentioned that they have reviewed people who returned, of whom about a third had been detained, about a fifth had been tortured, and a smaller proportion of those killed.
Yes, no, that's right.
So we do know a little bit about it, rather than, yeah, the simple disappearance, as in there are concrete risks. And
yes, oh no, very much so. Yes, they do a fantastic job. I get a lot of information from them because they do interview people in a systematic way on the ground. But of course, we know what the Syrian regime is capable of from things that have happened in the past, including the Caesar photographs, which you possibly remember, which were a series of photographs of people who had died in government custody in Syria, smuggled out by the man whose job it had been to photograph the corpses. And it was almost too horrible to believe, so that people spent a great deal of time trying to prove it wasn't true and the photographs were faked, but the upshot was that it wasn't. And I think if you have the apparatus set up to police your country that is full of people who have done that, then that's what that system is like now. That's what you go back into, a system that has completely corrupted itself by its ability to treat human beings as if they're not human at all. And we know that people who torture and abuse other human beings end up damaged and changed by it. You know, you can't do that and not lose all of your empathy, use all of your recognition that that's a person in front of you. And once that's happened, it's happened. And those are the people who are in charge in Syria, you know, and those are the people who will be in charge of you if you end up in the Syrian justice system. So it's easy to see how it happens, but I think when you start looking at whether Syria is a safe place to be now, you have to remember that that's what the last 5-10 years have made the Syrian apparatus into, and it's going to take a long time for that to change back, if it ever does.
And I don't think any Syrian refugees have been deported from the UK, have they? But I know there are other challenges in terms of...
No, that's right. Well, we're trying to, of course, stop them coming. There should be some sort of prejudgment on asylum seekers, depending on how they get here. And if they come by what the government likes to term illegal means, then they should not have the same rights to seek asylum. And, of course, the point about asylum is what you have to do is set foot on the territory of the country in which you wish to claim it by whatever means you can. And as long as when you set foot on it, you claim asylum, you've not broken international law. You've not attempted to stay without a visa. You've declared yourself. So that's not illegal. And, we signed up to the treaties that provide for that. I mean, we wrote the text of some of them. So it seems extraordinary that this sort of rhetoric has crept in about illegal entry into the UK. I find it hard to understand, and I don't know why it's not pushed back against more when it's said. And of course, more people are crossing by boat at the moment because there isn't any other way anymore. You know, we're not flying, or we are flying again a little bit, but with COVID checks and all the other things that go on, it must be much harder to smuggle somebody through on a flight. So people used famously to sort of land at Heathrow without a passport and request asylum at the passport gates, and those people aren't coming in anymore. Instead, they're buying a canoe in Calais and drowning. And it must be, you know, when you've come 10,000 kilometres and you've suffered some of the things that people have to suffer to get here, and you've taken a small boat across the Mediterranean, to stand in Calais and be able to see Dover, you can imagine how people must think, oh, I could just row that. After all these months or years of this desperation, I could just row that. Then when you hear people interview those who are trying to get here, it's heartbreaking to hear it, because they're asked why they want to come to the UK, and they're told, they say, because it's a decent country, it's a free country, I know I'll be safe there. And we ought to be proud of that. And instead we're, you know, talking about putting bollards in the sea. I despair, really.
Dr. Grimm there. Thanks to her and to Jane McKenzie and Karen Liebrich. That is it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again before the end of the year. It's possible. Stranger things have happened. It's a time of year for miracles, and so we will hope to be back once again in December. Thank you so much for listening. We do hope you've enjoyed it, and if you have enjoyed it, There is a large flat plan printed version of this podcast, which actually contains substantially more stories, journalism, jokes, cartoons, all of that. It's called Private Eye and it's available in all good shops now. But why bother with that when you can go to the website private-eye.co.uk and get yourself a subscription? Thank you again for listening to this podcast, Outpost of the Eye Empire. It was produced, as always, by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio, and we'll be back again sometime soon. See you then. Goodbye.